Hello and welcome to Father Figures, a show about parenting with an emphasis on fatherhood, uncommon fathers, fathers of all stripes. Here is where we explore the joys and griefs, the risks and rewards of being a dad. I'm Stephen Amaya. I'd like to get right into it today because I believe my guest has an interesting story and I'd like him to tell as much of it as possible. His name is Ryan Hamilton and he speaks of our indigenous people and his connection to them. He recently moved to Astoria with his wife and children. So let's go. He came to my studio and I started out by asking him what he does for a living.
I'm an educator. I was a high school history teacher for 10 years. And I'm currently a professional learning coach in the Ninth Grade Success Network.
That's great. What are the ages of your children?
My youngest is 7 and my oldest is 11.
11. So you have two daughters?
Mm-hmm, I do.
Okay. Now, one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you was because of your affiliation with indigenous people. And I'd like to hear a little bit about that because... after you talk about that, I want to ask about your kids' worldview about that. So anyway, so you have an affiliation with a...
I do. I grew up in a small fishing town on Prince of Wales Island named Craig, and one half of my family are Haida and come from Haida Gwaii, which is in Canada, the homeland of the Haida people. And... you know, right about the time the Spanish and the French started showing up, a smaller group of Haida called the Kaigani moved from Haida Gwaii up to Prince of Wales and started settling that island. Pretty much coincides with colonialism for the most part. And then the other half of my family is primarily Irish with a little bit of Scottish.
Yeah. Now, do your kids have a sense of a specific ethnicity or... are they sort of broadly, out there?
Yeah, it hit me hard the other day. My youngest, she's like, "Daddy, am I Alaskan? I'm Alaskan, right?" I was like, "Oh, babe, you got Alaskan blood in you, that's for sure. But we live in Oregon, and while we do go back to Alaska every summer, you know, like, yes, you know, so, kind of charting that ground for her. But I could see, you know, she had that sense of pride, you know, where we go back in the summers and she knows her family and her extended family up there and already feels connected at a young age. And, you know, so much so that she wants to, identify as Alaskan.
Excellent. Yeah. That's wonderful. Now, is your father still alive?
Yes, he is.
Tell me about your father.
Yeah. He also grew up same town. Commercial fishing, all of... he and his brothers and his dad and all of his dad's brothers were all commercial fishermen. And when he started working for the Postal Service when he had a family, just to have a more kind of balanced at home on land lifestyle. So we jumped around Southeast Alaska a little bit town to town until we made it back to Craig where his side of the family originates from. And so I ended up graduating out of there and he currently is retired. He now lives out across in Lyell, Washington. So right near White Salmon.
Okay.
Yeah. My father's dad, my grandfather, who lived to be 103 and just passed away a couple of months ago, actually, when he died, he was considered to be the oldest living Haida left in the world and was celebrated and honored for that and for his life. And so the story goes back a little bit because when he was 12, his mother died and he was sent to a boarding school called Sheldon Jackson, a couple of islands north of there. And so really didn't grow up with his family, although he knew a lot of other kids and stuff and so forth who had kind of went to school with him. But so there's a generational thing going on there. There's my grandfather who grew up speaking Haida and grew up at that time period, went to boarding school, got out, enlisted in the Navy, World War II. And now, you know, fast forward to my father's generation, it wasn't necessarily good for them to claim to be native, right? In that time period, the more native you were, the harder life really was for you, and unfortunately. And so I'm happy to be a part of a generation that's able to you know, be able to have the space to re-identify as Native and be proud of that. And yeah. And as a result, you know, you'll see if anybody's able to get to Southeast Alaska, there's a Native Renaissance, the cultural Renaissance going on across Southeast Alaska right now.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned to me earlier that you were recently involved in the raising of a totem pole.
I was. Yeah.
Tell me about that.
A spectacular experience. You know, some cultures have, since time immemorial, have moved stones and built amazing infrastructure, things that last thousands of years. And what the Haida did was they moved massive trees, you know, whether that was making some of the biggest canoes and sailing ships that and becoming some of the greatest mariners to raising some of the biggest totem poles anywhere in the world. And so amazingly, I got to go and be a part of an eagle pole raising just in October. And it
was it moving? I mean,
it was super emotional. Yep. The first day we moved it from the carving shed through town. And so we packed it through town with drums and singing and a whole parade. They shut down the schools to bring all the kids down there. And, you know, most of the people in the town were there, and people from, I'd say 10 or 12 different towns from all over came for the event. And so the first day was moving it from the carving shed to the place where it would be raised, and then followed by potlatch for the next 6 or 7 hours in the high school gym. And then the next day was the raising day. And so we raised the pole that day and followed by potlatch the rest of the night.
Now, if I wanted to see this pole, where would I go?
Yeah, you go to Craig, Alaska, and you go right down to the Craig Tribal Hall, and you can't, you know, you go to Craig, Alaska, you're not going to be able to miss it.
Yeah. Okay, that's cool. What prompted your move south?
You know, as a kid growing up, it's pretty isolated. You know, it's a town about 1,000 people, you know, so I had, my graduating class was 18 kids.
Yeah.
And so I was definitely pretty restless. And fortunately, as a young kid in Alaska, you can make a lot of money in the summers working the docks, working boats in the fishing industry. So I had money and I just wanted to travel. I just had the bug and I just needed to go see the world for myself. I was tired of being cooped up on an island. We called it growing up on the rock. So
the rock.
I had to get off the rock. And
where'd you go?
Yeah, so I, you know, went to school in Ashland, Oregon, and loved that. That was a great decision. It wasn't Washington, so it wasn't just the next state down, and it wasn't California, so it wasn't like too far away, you know. So I got to Ashland, and then by my second year there, though, I did a study abroad program, and I lived in India for the better part of that year doing ecological field study in the Himalayas. And so that really, really opened my mind to the broader world. And from that point on, I mean, travel and international experience has just been a part of my DNA.
Now, did that travel, that DNA you have has a lot of indigenous quality to it, and did you have a sense of that when you were abroad, that you had a connection with?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it was amazing. The Tibetan people, actually look to me like Eskimo people, like Northern mm-hmm. Aleut people, like Northern Alaskan natives. You really saw, like, you know, well, you rewind 10, 12,000 years, right? These are folks coming across a land bridge, right? And so there was a DNA there. And not only just that in the way people appeared, but in wooden carvings and ovoid, like relief carvings, and just the way of life as well, you know. So and some matrilineal associations there too, because the Haida people follow the mother's line. And there's some of that deep culturally in the Nepalese region as well.
Wow. Why do you think we have these walls between cultures? Mm. You know, part of it is like protectionism,
mm-hmm.
but there's something else. There's something else that's afoot, even in our own culture,
mm-hmm.
about others,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I think a person with your kind of DNA, as you put it, has a view into that
mm-hmm.
that other people don't, especially with your travels and your ability to sort of go through those walls.
Yeah.
You know,
it's a
hard question.
It's a big question. You know, you said wall. So I was actually traveling in Israel and Jordan and the West Bank, before this most recent and devastating conflict arose. And I was in Jerusalem sitting up on a hill, looking out over the city. And of course it's a big walled city. And I just, you know, having a real moment there, and it just really hit me, you know, like these walls are big. These are walls made of 1,000-ton, you know, stones, and they're separating people. But I felt in that moment that like the walls in our hearts are even stronger than the walls that I'm seeing here around this most ancient of cities, right? At that cultural kind of confluence. So it's, you know, people have a deep need to belong. And I really wonder if, you know, if that's at the core of it, you know, where do I belong in this world? And for me, you know, I, growing up in a small place in Alaska, having indigenous roots, Haida roots, but also being white and with European ancestry as well, it was confusing. And I felt like I needed to go out in the world to figure out where I belonged. And it is hard because, you know, ultimately we're all indigenous to planet Earth, and we all ultimately do belong. And as like opening up our hearts and minds to that bigger picture, I think we get isolated into these bubbles and we think I can only belong in one place. And oh, people have been conditioned to believe that and to live that way. And so opening yourself up to a broader perspective of our place, not just in the world, but in the universe, I think allows you, hopefully, right, to drop some of those walls in your heart and in your mind.
Yeah. Now, do your children have a sense of this, of the indigenous stuff, or you know, how much does it propel them?
Mm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, they are creatures of nature for sure, and I think that's the way it's manifested is in stories, myths, and in connection with nature. Kind of like a deep connection, a spiritual connection. Mm-hmm. Recognizing, you know, the deep beauty in the place that we live, the animals and the plants that surround this wonderful place that we live, and being free to sort of explore your own spiritual connection with the land, I think is the most deeply indigenous concept that there is, mm-hmm. you know, outside of the color of your skin and where you might come from is, mm-hmm. is how deeply are you connected with the land?
Yeah. Now, do you get out with your daughters?
Yeah. I'll as often as possible.
Yeah. have you ever received any pushback from exploring your indigenous stuff? Because of your appearance.
Mm-hmm.
So have you gotten any pushback or any critical inquisitiveness?
Mm-hmm. I mean, to be honest with you, the most pushback I've got is in my own head, you know, about showing up and claiming my roots, especially outside of Alaska, is, you know, I kind of pick and choose my spots for that. Cause I just don't want to tokenize or trivialize,
right.
You know,
now to be honest, if you looked different, your behavior would be different.
It's so true.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
The way in which we show up in the world and the way people expect us to be, we sort
yes.
of identify that way. And yeah.
Now when you go back, beyond your father, mm-hmm. into your indigenous roots, mm-hmm. how far back can you go?
Yeah, that's a really special thing. All the way back to Haida Gwaii. Mm-hmm. So I have a family tree, and because, you know, associations with there's some history there, but Alaska Natives were able to claim through lawsuits, right, to get 44 million acres worth of land back in Alaska in the 1970s. And from that, instead of the reservation system, they were able to get land, and then they were set up in a corporation type of system. So there's 12 regional corporations across the state that are indigenous run by tribes. And then there's also village corporations. So Sea Alaska is the regional corporation, whereas Shaanxi'it is the village corporation in the town in which I came from, which, you know, has become sort of a repository for lineage.
Okay.
And to establish lineage. I actually have a spreadsheet that goes back at least 6 or 7 generations, uh-huh. If not more. And of course, it's amazing how wide the family tree gets so quick.
How does this relate to fatherhood? You know, what's the lineage like in that culture? I mean, is it you mentioned matrilinear.
Mm-hmm.
So are fathers regarded differently, or?
So you, as a son, your uncles traditionally would have primary authorship over your life. You know, your uncles can teach you a sense of discipline that your father's not able to. So traditionally, you're raised by your father as well, but you're taught by your uncles. And but yes, everybody follows their mother's line. So, and also there's a separation between the tribe of called in a sense of moiety. So there's a raven clan and an eagle clan, mm-hmm. and ravens can only marry eagles and eagles can only marry ravens, so that there's not this family kind of intermingling going on. And then in the sense of my grandfather, who is a raven, mm-hmm. and his wife is an eagle, so all of her children, my father, are eagles. Mm-hmm. And so that makes me a raven following my mother's line, and my children are eagles. Yeah.
Wow. That's and you'd live that. Mm-hmm. That's, I can tell just by looking at you that this is something you live and breathe.
Yeah, that's really important.
What do you miss most from your youth, mm-hmm. insofar as being indigenous?
You know, I mean, from my youth, I miss, you know, I know what I miss. Sitting on the floor with that utmost respect, looking up at elders, sitting there telling stories. Being a kid, we were taught, you know, like, number one, you respect your elders always, you know, no matter what. And part of that was sit and listen and be quiet. And that just was, even to this day, when I would go home to, you know, be with my grandfather while he was still around, or even now my uncles and aunties as they're getting older, I just have this thing. I want to go, you know, if we're in the living room, I just want to go sit on the floor, and I want to sit kind of at their feet, and mm-hmm. I want to listen, and I want to ask questions. And that's what it makes me feel like a kid. But it makes me feel like I'm also honoring family and honoring them, and in so doing, honoring myself and the experience of being in relationship with them. So, yeah, that's, I think, what comes to mind.
Did you ever consider being a stay-at-home dad?
It was being a teacher and having young kids at home was really, really hard. You know, you got hundreds of kids every day that you feel like you're, you know, have this special relationship with, and are, you know, you have this sense of responsibility towards them. And then you also got your own kids at home. And there came a point to where I felt like I was, you know, spending more time, stress, energy, love, exertion on other people's children and not my own. And so when COVID came around and shut everything down, mm-hmm. and I was at home, you know, still working and trying to teach online, that's when it really hit me. And my kids were getting older. I was like, mm-hmm. you know, I should try to see if I can find something else that would let me. And so I was able to find this professional learning coach job, mm-hmm. for the ESD, in which I'm able to support all the high schools in the region. And I go in and work with teachers and students in the ninth grade level to just generally improve systems for students. That allows me to work multiple days each week from home. So, that's now I'm in my year four of that. So I feel like I'm getting to have a dose of the stay at home dad. Even though I am constantly busy, I'm there when, you know, I can take them to school, and I'm there most days when they get off the bus. And that's
how old is your eldest?
She's in fifth grade, 11.
Fifth grade. Yeah. Okay, 11. So, yeah, okay. So you have 7 years to go.
I do. You know, and we just showed up in Astoria, and my youngest is seven. So I'm like, this is going to be a great 10-year chapter right here. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. Well, it's a great town to be in. You know, it really does punch above its weight.
Yeah, we've been trying to move here for a solid 3 or 4 years. So finally happened.
Is there a worldview that you'd like to impart, or are you just letting them grow? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, there is. I want my kids, even though they're going to show up in the world as white kids, they beautiful white girls with red hair, and they're that's how they're going to show up in the world. But they have Alaskan roots. And we go back every summer, and they know quite a bit of the history. They can tell you stories. They can tell you some myths. They can explore the nuances of some of the cultural differences that they see in people, and they see in the world around them as a result. And they're very curious. As something, I think, as far as imparting anything at this point, you know, especially as a kid, you're still making sense of the world. But I think as long as, you know, you're asking questions and you're curious and you can follow your own lines of inquiry and you have people around you who are going to honor that and tell you the truth if and when they know it and admit it when they don't, mm-hmm. you know, I think that's a solid platform for building one's own identity.
It sounds like... I did this with my own kid, and I have one daughter, and we sort of dream and project stuff about our kids, and what would be like the best outcome, mm-hmm. For you as a father, seeing, you know, what would show you that you've been a success as a father?
Hmm. Well, I mean, first off, the top of the list is, you know, loving oneself, you know, and being comfortable in who you are and accepting yourself no matter where you are in life. So if I see my daughters as, you know, they don't need other people to affirm their own existence, that they can be in this world and be secure and comfortable in who they are, you know, that's going to be the most important thing for their life, as far as I see. In that way, they can self-determine from that point on. You know, they're good. There's a whole slew of other things. I think I've got an 11-year-old, but of course she's starting to act like a little teenager at this point. Yeah. And I always told myself, you know, and I was never able to, you know, if I was in trouble, if I was doing something out in the world as a teenager that I shouldn't be doing, it was never a thought in my mind like, hey, call up my parents and ask for help, or call my parents to get a ride home or something like that. And I've been waiting, you know, that if and when something happens and my daughters are teenagers and they're in a tough place and they know that they might get in trouble for the situation that they found themselves in, but they still call me and I can still go and pick them up and we can still talk about it, I think I'm going to hold off feeling like a successful father until that moment happens.
Well, your eldest is 11. So I don't imagine there's any real conscious awareness of colonialism yet.
A little bit.
A little bit?
Yeah. Yeah. Some, you know, they're learning history in school and she learns it from me. I mean, I'm a history teacher and I've taken the stance from day one. This is something I thought long and hard about, was I didn't want to be the kind of dad is like, you can't handle the truth, you know, and I'm going to tell you how it is, you know. But I told myself that if my kids ask me a question, then that means they're ready for some type of answer and explanation. Not a deep and thorough, complex explanation, but at least an answer right off the top. And so when it comes to the, you know, the impacts of colonialism, she's already wondering about those things, asking deep questions about those things. And both my daughters, you know, I listen to a lot of indigenous music. And so a lot of what the girls get in lyrics, right, is prompting their wonderings and our conversation. And I feel like rather than me bringing it to them, it can just come from their environment, you know, and from us engaging in the arts and engaging in culture. And that's, I think, been an effective way of, you know, guiding them to certain perspectives or awareness, different questions. And it's frustrating because they want to be on one, they want to be on the good side, you know, that we don't, they want to be, you know, they don't want to be, to have to see themselves as descendants of, you know, something that they think the is colonial. Horrendous, right? And but of course there's so much more nuance than just good guys and bad guys, and we have to sort of, you know, blow that notion up anyways just to exist in this world. So
yeah, everybody does. Yeah. All right. Well, Ryan Hamilton, thank you for being a guest on Father Figures.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. You. Yeah, thanks for having me on.
All right. All right. There's a phrase Ryan used a couple of times in the interview, and it struck me as at once simple yet philosophical. And the phrase is, quote, how you show up in the world, unquote. That hit me as really important because it represents a choice. You put on your face, but you have to take your heart with you, and your ethics and your truth come with you too, and I guess it behooves one to know what they are when one shows up in the world. Thank you for listening. I want to thank Ryan Hamilton for his gracious acceptance to be interviewed. I also want to thank Jason Shaw of Audionautics.com for the music, and also thanks to CC Blanca for production assistance. And please remember, any questions or comments can be shot directly to me at RadioRanchero@gmail.com. I'm happy to answer any and all. So until next time, remember, the days may be long, but the years are short. Bye-bye.